Time now for Connecting the Diocese.
One of the most oft-quoted quotes of St. Francis, preach the gospel all time and occasionally use words. The whole idea is that you preach by your life, preach by how you live, you preach by what you do, how you behave. Those sorts of things are so important.
Connecting the Diocese is a production of the Diocese of La Crosse.
Well, hi there, Jack Socia here with you, host of Connecting the Diocese from the Diocese of La Crosse, Wisconsin. So happy that you can be with us on this last show of January. We've managed to get through that, and maybe we'll warm up a little bit more in February if we're really, really lucky. You know, I was thinking about what to do for the show this week, something a little bit different. We're going to be talking about, outer space. Yes, outer space, with an expert from our diocese, as a matter of fact. We'll also be talking about faith and science and people who've lost faith in science, as well as those who are just exploring their own faith. So a lot to pack into this show. But you know, we've been under the shadow of what I call the two P's, the pandemic and politics. For the past 2 years, our attention has been focused on all of the stuff going on and all of the change. And at the same time, for this past 2 years, some remarkable, incredible things have been happening in outer space, and good old US of A has had a lot to do with it. We now have not one, but two private companies, private individuals, not the government, launching people into space. Think about that. I remember the years when, you know, it was a major project with the government, and oh my goodness, you know. Now they're sending William Shatner up in space as a guest on board a spacecraft. Think about that. Some of you are probably old enough to remember when launching stuff into space was new and exciting and kind of creepy and kind of dangerous. Around the time we had Alan Shepard go up in a ballistic missile, and later John Glenn orbiting the Earth, they put up years ago, around 1962, I think it was a satellite. It was a satellite called Telstar. And this thing, I'm sure it was the size of a good-sized medicine ball, had a whole bunch of solar panels stuck in it so that no matter which direction it was in, something would be getting hit by the sun. And it was designed so that people could make a telephone call from Earth, and the telephone call would go up to the satellite, and then it would send it back down to, say, Europe, as opposed to using the transatlantic cable, which had been around since the late 19th century. Now, today you go, yeah. So back then, this was so exciting that we put up this thing that would actually do something that they actually made a pop song about it called Telstar by a group called the Tornadoes. And it became a big time hit in the USA. We were extremely proud of the fact that we managed to get this thing up and actually it did something useful for the average person. Also, keep in mind that the so-called sounds of satellites was still something brand new to us. Telemetry was kind of like a new sound. And so at the beginning of the song, and I'm just going to play 1 minute of it. I don't want you to hear the whole thing. You'll hear what they decided in 1962 would be like cool space sounds. But the song does reflect something more. We were very proud of this thing being up there doing its job, and it's reflected in the style of instrumental music. So here's just a minute or so of Telstar by the Tornadoes. Yes, there it goes with its telemetry humming, Telstar from 1962. That song, by the way, was covered by several other groups as well. It was that popular. And yes, as a kid, I went out and bought the 45 RPM version of that particular song. Yeah, I would love to have been an astronaut, except for a couple of small problems. I wasn't old enough. I wasn't smart enough. I wore pretty strong corrective lenses in my glasses, and I was a little bit prone to car sickness. Probably not a good idea. We'll be right back after this on Connecting the Diocese. We'll get right back to the show in just a minute or so. For those of you listening in the Diocese of La Crosse, you should note that there will be a pledge drive coming up, not this coming weekend after this one, but the one following that, which means that the Saturday version of the show will not be aired because of the pledge drive going on. So if you want to listen to it, you either have to listen on Sunday or wait and just go to the diocesan website, diolc.org/connecting, and you can either listen online or you can download it and listen later. But that's not the main focus of what I want to talk to you about. You know, for the past 10 years, the folks at Relevant Radio have provided the Diocese of La Crosse airtime to air this show at no charge. That's a tremendous value. And quite frankly, if it wasn't for that, I doubt if we would have been able to produce this show every week for 10 years, because the cost of airing it would have just been prohibitive. There would be other things that required payment as well. So when they do get the pledge drive going, again, not this week, but the following week, consider that. Consider that when they talk about all the different value that they are offering people in the Diocese of La Crosse. They've done a lot for us at no charge, just to be good neighbors. And it's worth your financial support. We, of course, are always asking you for money as well. The Bishop's Annual Appeal is ongoing, and that money gets spread out throughout the diocese and throughout all the different agencies that it supports, Catholic Charities, among many others. Very, very busy this time of year. But at the same time, we have to remember our friends. We have to remember those who are giving us the opportunity to reach out to you every single week with this show, and that would be the folks at Relevant Radio. So when they come asking about maybe helping them out a little bit, you may want to give it a really serious consideration. And I thank you very much for anything you can do to give them your support. Relevant Radio, a big part of Connecting the Diocese. Well, again, thanks so much for tuning in, Connecting the Diocese. As promised, on the line with me from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Father James Krasinski, pastor at St. Olaf Parish. Father, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jack. It's always a joy to have you on.
There have been so many things of technological wonder going on these past few months. Shooting William Shatner into space was one of them.
As a Star Trek kid growing up, there was a certain moment of delight with that as well.
And the idea that these spacecraft are now in the hands of private enterprise, so that, you know, we can send our astronauts up to the International Space Station in our own rockets. We don't have to go over to the Cosmodrome in the former Soviet Union to do this. And also, I must say, as I mentioned, when we had a discussion about this with Bishop, because he likes the same stuff too, that they sure have made the spacesuits look a lot cooler.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, they now look more like what we saw in some of the far-off futuristic science fiction movies, you know. But now we got all this new stuff going on. The big thing that caught our eye was that there's a new space telescope that went up, and they just announced about a day before we were recording this that it's now 1,000,000 miles away.
Correct.
And number one, what is this thing called?
It's called the James Webb Space Telescope.
And it's named after James Webb, who is who? How come that wasn't the Father James Krasinski?
I would have loved that.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, but but it was James Webb instead, not to be confused with Del Webb, who got Sun City, Arizona going. It's a different Webb. I know nothing about him. Who was he?
James Webb was a boss for the space agency. And when we look at his influence, he was instrumental. He was the second NASA administrator under John F. Kennedy. And he was considered to be one of the most innovative scientists, mission leaders for NASA. And so therefore, NASA has a tradition of when you have these prominent figures like this to name the things they put up in space after them. So, yeah, he was really big in the NASA community, and to honor him, they named it after him. And ironically, you don't have to necessarily work for NASA or the European Space Agency to get something named after you. For example, Georges Lemaître, Catholic priest who was the father of what he called the cosmic egg, but later got dubbed the Big Bang Theory. The European Space Agency named a probe after him because of the historic significance. So it's not just office bigwigs, but also scientists and people who have made major scientific contributions.
So there is hope yet that there may be a Father James Kaczynski booster that falls back into the sea.
I'm hoping for an asteroid. If they would name an asteroid after me, I'd be satisfied. They can have the telescope, yeah, as long as it's not an asteroid that's on a collision course.
Yeah, please, no.
That'd be too much fodder for my parishioners to basically say, great, the asteroid that's going to end the world is named after our pastor. That would not be a good thing.
A Valentine Day thing well over 30 years ago when I was still working down in Texas was this thing called the International Star Registry, where you could have a star named after your loved one. And you would get this framed certificate. And I got one from my wife. And, you know, we all kind of knew it was nonsense, but it was cute. You know, like, it probably really isn't officially named that star. And there are quite a few stars out there. So they're not going to run out. There's only a limited number of stars left. Call today. But
when I was at Roncalli and Newman, you know, some students did the same thing for me in terms of they got a star named after me. And I think that those little gestures that, you know, that we can know that it's not really legit, it's more of, but I think it points to a basic intuition, and it's actually something at our last Faith in Astronomy workshop I talked about, is that in the psychology of the stars, every culture throughout history has wanted their story to be reflected in the stars, and they wanted to have some type of reality that there was a connection with them in the other direction, too. Because it's an odd thing to think about. So, for example, constellations. The Greek mythology has constellations. Asian cultures have constellations. Native American cultures had constellations. And the funny thing is, with all that, way, way back, thousands of years before Christ, there wasn't an international constellation committee that sat down saying, okay, what story are you going to tell? What story are you going to tell? There's something intuitive in all human cultures throughout history that we want to put our story in the stars, and we want the stars to make sense on Earth. And I think there's something in that that I still have to mine spiritually of why. Why do we want that depth of connection, regardless of what culture we belong to? So,
yeah, it's good. Well, they just, people want to be remembered in some way, and the stars are so great. Now, the other thing, and this is off the topic we're talking about, I also read someplace that the old, and it's still working apparently, Voyager spacecraft, which has been going since like the 70s, is like so far away now that it's almost unimaginable, and apparently they can still get it to send back, you know, little beeps or whatever, letting it know that it's still working.
Yeah, and it's still sending back usable data, and it's the first human-made object that has officially left all the gravitational influence of our star in our solar system, and it is now officially in the unknown realm of just deep space.
Yeah, it's just out there somewhere. And it does have on board some analog stuff that can be seen by human or alien eyes, for that matter, that indicate who we were, who we are. And so who knows? I mean, who knows what's going to happen with all that stuff?
The mother of all needle in the haystacks right now.
That's right. You never can tell. You just never can tell. The thing that always popped up a few years ago, I was listening to some show where we had shot, maybe it was the Hubble telescope. I don't, we shot a probe or something out to Jupiter. I have no idea where it was. And somebody called up, and this thing cost $100 million. Mm-hmm. And the guy said, how can you take $100 million of taxpayer money and shoot it into space? And the guy from NASA said, sir, the money's not in the spacecraft. The money is in the pockets of the people who designed and built and launched the spacecraft. And so this thing that is now a million miles away from us is not full of dollar bills that, yep. that came from taxpayers. Those are in all kinds of bank accounts of all kinds of laborers and scientists and mathematicians and everybody you can think of, fuel suppliers, you name it. And we'll probably do a great deal to help us understand more about what's around us, which I'm going to ask you about in just a minute, what exactly they're supposed to do. But also just the technology that was developed. It filters down into every little thing that we have now. I picked up, it was a secondhand camera that was 5 years old, but originally it was around $300, a little Olympus, not quite pocket-sized camera. And I was toying around with the controls on this thing, looking at the stuff it does. And in addition to the fact that it for something that you could hold in the palm of your hand, the lens goes out an enormous way, but also deep in the menu under so-called scenes, you know, where you can get snow or you can get beach or sports, there was ones where that if it recognizes a cat's face, it will take a picture of it. And if you recognize if a dog walks in front of the camera and it spots a dog face, it will take a picture of it. Now, this is stuff, believe it or not, that was developed originally not for our use, but maybe for military use and also for space to recognize things. I mean, it's just amazing how this stuff just in a matter of years ends up in something that you carry in your pocket. It's kind of crazy. What is this thing supposed to do out there?
Yeah, so the James Webb Telescope is going to be looking at a very specific wavelength of light that we know as infrared. And the reason it's doing that, so like for example, the Hubble Space Telescope. The Hubble Space Telescope looks at visual light, meaning light that's in the spectrum that we can see. However, the light that we can't see is in the infrared spectrum. And the reason why that's important, you know, think about, for those of you who might be weather enthusiasts out there, if you go to like a weather website or something and you look at the different kinds of radars they have, you know, they might have what's the cloud cover and that type of stuff. And there's most likely going to be some form of infrared radar on that weather, because the reason is that in the infrared light spectrum, you can measure how certain things react in ways you can't with visual light. And so therefore, this is going to be a very different type of space telescope from Hubble, a very much bigger. So I believe it's, can't remember how many times bigger it is. It's going to be about 100 times more powerful than the Hubble Space Telescope in terms of its ability to see things. But it is going to specifically analyze infrared light signatures, both in terms of objects in our solar system, but also the really exciting stuff of starting to look at infrared signatures of exoplanets, meaning planets are orbiting other stars, and also delving into a region of the universe we know nothing about, is the regions where we can look where to visual light, it looks like there's nothing, but in the infrared might hold some of the keys towards how did the stars come about close to the beginning of creation. Because as I've shared with your audience in the past, there's different analogies that you can use to try to understand what are you looking at when you look at the night sky. So when you look at the sun, you don't look at the sun, but the sun, when you feel the heat of the sun hit you on a normal day when it's sunny out and no clouds, it took, I believe it's 6 to 8 minutes for that sun you feel to travel from the sun to hit you. Now, that's important because then when we look at distant stars, that's the whole point of light years. So therefore, if a star is 4 light years away, it takes 4 years for that light to get to us. If a star is 1 million light years away, it took 1 million years for that light to get to us. If it was 13.7, it took 13.7 billion years for that light to get to us. And so therefore, when you look at the stars, some use like an archaeology dig or a history book or a museum type of a thing. You really don't see the objects as they are right now. You see them as they were 1 million, 13 billion years ago. So in these deepest parts of space, 13 billion years and further, there's, for lack of a term, this void that appears to have nothing, but science is pretty sure in the infrared spectrum with the James Webb is able to detect some of the most ancient goings on in the material sense of our universe. shortly after the Big Bang. I get a little annoyed when I hear, oh, it's going to be able to look and see the moment of creation. No, it's not. That's not true of the James Webb. What it will do is it'll fill in that gap of when we observe with the best telescopes in the world, we can go back to a point when we have the oldest stars, but then there's no stars. And then the question logically comes, well, how did those first stars come about? And the hope is that with this incredibly powerful infrared telescope, they'll be able to pick up on infrared light signatures that'll answer the question of how did the first stars form? And how did, in a real way, everything begin? Because right now there's a huge gap in our knowledge, and that's one of the many things that James Webb is going to be looking for.
This thing, if I remember reading somewhere, some parts of it, and this whole thing kind of unfolds, opens up, but it's not, these are not glass lenses that are sitting out there. That I think parts of it, there's a shade or something that was going to deploy that I think was the size of tennis courts.
One tennis court.
Oh, okay. There was something else that was even bigger, but was coming unfolded from this thing. And they referred to how they managed to pack this down so that it unfolded as being kind of like origami. And the other thing is that we have to trust that they got it right, because we can't sit there and go, well, let me adjust this like I can do a volume control on this recorder. It doesn't work that way. And it worked.
Yeah, to kind of break this down, one of the fair criticisms of the James Webb telescope, I think it was something delayed for like 25 years in terms of the launch. And some people, I remember Congress even tried to squelch it at one point because of budget overages, but then the Senate stepped in and said, no, continue on with it. And the reason why it was so delayed is precisely the reason that you're talking about, that when you're going to be putting an object a million miles away from the Earth, 4 to 5 times the distance between the Earth and the Moon, you can't send astronauts out there to fix it. So if something messes up, it's basically a big block of junk in space. So they had to do everything they could ground-based to problem-solve every single possible fault and failure that could happen to make sure that this could actually do what it's going to do. The classic line from the movie Apollo 13, you know, failure's not an option. Failure's not an option with this telescope, because it has to work the first time. And so therefore, you have these incredibly thin, I believe there's 5 layers of heat shield that, as you rightly said, were packed up in origami. The telescope itself is made of a series of octagonal gold-plated panels that had to be folded up too. All of that was functional. They had to fit it on the head of a rocket because it was the only way they could get it out. And so they had to somehow pack this up into a rocket head, have it survive the jar of liftoff from one of the most powerful rockets in the world, survive then being let go from the head of this rocket, avoiding space junk and all that kind of stuff that's floating around the Earth, and then slowly unfold and finding its home a million miles away. The stress that must have been on the scientists who were doing this must have been immense. I can't even fathom what that would be like.
No. It was also like that, you know, several months ago they landed that that Mars rover, and they had come up with a new way of doing it, where basically, instead of trying to wrap it in a gigantic thing of bubble wrap and having it hit Mars, you know, or various things they've tried over the years, they had this kind of a vehicle that came down and hovered just above the surface. It did not actually land, and then lower the thing basically on a rope. And I was watching this because I don't watch this stuff all the time, but this was pretty exciting stuff. And I was looking at the techs, the people, the scientists who did all this. Number one, like you say, the tension must have been unbearable. And of course, I'm older, but they really all look like they should still be in college.
Yeah.
You know, or working as a barista over at Starbucks. Yeah. And they had designed this thing, and they had come up with a total different way of doing it. Instead of having it impact, bang, and hopefully it bounces properly, they had it slow down and, like, lower it on a rope. It was great to see. And that crazy thing is just doing just fine, as is the original one, which is still going on out there. So we're living in a wonderful age of this kind of thing going on.
I'm embarrassed to admit it, it, and some of your audience might roll their eyes. I was literally praying as that rocket took off, because I watched the launch online, and I grabbed my rosary and just started praying, because I thought, oh, I don't want to see that thing blow up in our atmosphere. That would just be horrific, you know, just with all the hopes and excitement and expectations on it. So,
and also what we're going to learn, and all of this is going to filter down into the everyday life, not only in terms of, you know, as I said, some of the technology going on, but we have no idea what we're going to get a better understanding. We can't really understand the vastness of what's out there. I was down literally deep in the heart of Texas a number of years ago at night, and it was for the first time, because I was up in the hill country where there weren't the big Texas theme park, Fiesta Texas, hasn't been built yet in near San Antonio. And so there were no lights. And I, for the first time I ever really saw the Milky Way. And for me, I mean, you probably have seen tons of times, but I looked at it, and I'm not even that smart about it. I don't know if I am looking at the milkiness is a collection of stars or a collection of galaxies that have tons of stars in them. I don't even know. Which is it? Are we seeing galaxies? What am I seeing up there?
Yeah. And the beautiful thing is just you're seeing a little bit of everything. Sometimes it's stars, sometimes it's galaxies. My favorite thing to try to take pictures of is nebulae, gas clouds, because oftentimes some of the gas clouds, some of them are just dust. But some of them that are hot enough are actually kind of like star nurseries where stars are being born and infant stars reside. Now, granted, infant in the galactic sense, you know, 44 million years is a baby star in terms of age, but it's a place of wonder and mystery, and it constantly draws our attention if we allow ourselves to really gaze and just ask the basic questions of what's up there, how did it get there, and how am I connected to it?
And we have a better idea of figuring out some of this stuff. And it'll keep getting better as time goes by. But speaking of getting better as time goes by, and I this is just something because I'm kind of a techie guy, as you are too. I thought it was terribly funny. Now, you are affiliated with the Vatican Observatory. Let me mention that. You are helped get the faith and science conferences going. You've spoken at them. You do go around giving talks in various places. And you went somewhere with what you thought was pretty up-to-date gear to see and photograph stars, you know, with things to match the rotation of the Earth and things like that. And what did you find out?
Well, the funny thing was, is that, so our Faith and Astronomy Workshop has been renamed as the Astronomy for Catholics in Ministry and Education, or ACME. So with COVID, we haven't had a conference in a while. So Brother Guy called and said, we have to have a conference. I don't care if we just have five people show up. We're going to have a conference in Tucson. So I went down, and being that, and I've always, since a kid, wanted to get into astrophotography, but especially with COVID and social distancing and having to find things to kind of mentally get away from the stress of COVID, I just said, you know what? Now's the time. I'm going to get into astrophotography. And it really, just from a standpoint of a personal benefit, it really helped me in this COVID time to just have that mental break from the stress that we all feel through this pandemic. But with that, you know, Brother Guy said, well, why don't you bring your stuff down and have your presentation this time around be on astrophotography? And so I have this kind of a little Swiss watch design star tracker that once you, you know, align it to Polaris, you just wind it up and it ticks away, and you mount your camera on it and it tracks the stars and that kind of stuff. And I was thinking I was just going to really, woo everybody. I also had a little mount for a cell phone, because now with cell phones, you can start to use them like what I would say real cameras in terms of playing with shutter speed and aperture and all that kind of stuff and ISO settings. It's still limited, but just to kind of show them, hey, you can take some nice pictures on your smartphone too. You know, you don't have to just always buy a, you know, camera. Well, now with the iPhone 13 and the Google Pixel, I can't remember the exact name of it, the latest Google phone. So I'm setting up my little rig. And then there were some of them, this handheld, were like taking shots of the constellation Orion. They were spectacular. And I'm just like, well, that kind of blew my presentation. I just, and so the, you know, with computational imaging technology in cell phones. It's unbelievable what you can do now. Now, that being said, that you really can't, you still can't do like deep space observing with smartphones. But if you're just looking to get, oh, there's the constellation Orion, or there's the Big Dipper, or there's the Little Dipper, I'll bet you most of your audiences, if you have a cell phone that's 5 years old or less, you can probably take incredibly good pictures with your smartphone. Some smartphones even have an astrophotography mode on it. You just have to dig around and find it. It's unbelievable where technology has taken us.
It really is. Like I say, I mean, I was surprised last night to find the thing on this regular compact digital camera that, you know, would wait until a cat's face appeared. And basically, this is doing the same thing, only on your smartphone and only with the stars coming up, aligning them properly. It is remarkable. It is just, all this stuff is moving very quickly, and people, if you stay, you know, on top of it, it really is thrilling. But if you don't stay on top of it, which is understandable, we got lots of stuff going on in the world, sometimes you don't realize how wild and amazing it has gotten. We are beginning at this point, just beginning to seriously consider the idea that there's going to be somebody going to Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you look at little kids walking around, and you think one of these people could be the commander of a spacecraft going to Mars. We have no idea. We just have no idea. There are also,
ironically, the James Webb Space Telescope will help with that too. Not only is it going to look into the deepest parts of the universe, but one of the scientists I was reading that was awarded time in year one of James Webb, one of her projects is to look at the infrared spectrum of Mars's atmosphere. James Webb always has to be pointed away from the sun, otherwise it'll get destroyed. And so therefore it can't image, it'll never be able to image the moon, earth, or sun, but everything the other direction it will. And so one of the projects is going to be to understand in tremendous detail the atmosphere of Mars to contribute to having people set foot on Mars for the first time.
Isn't that wild? We're going to take a break in just a second, but also you had made a comment when I was arranging this conversation with you, something about the telescope is orbiting around nothing.
Yeah.
Now, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What does orbiting around nothing mean? It sounds like something from Seinfeld, but yeah. Go ahead. What is it?
Yeah, and so basically it gets into the science of what are called Lagrange points. So, long story short, if you think of think of the face of a clock. You know, you got noon, 12 at the top, 6 at the bottom, 3 and 9. If you were to put the sun dead center on your clock where the hands come together, and the Earth right on the rim of 12 o'clock, on the rim of your clock, there are 5 points that you can figure out through geometry, and the scientist or the mathematician Lagrange put this idea forward way before we even had the ability to go into space, that there would be in the orbits of planets these certain points. And what they are gravitational anomalies where, and every planet has them. So, you know, you can put the Earth at noon, you can put Jupiter at noon. Any planet's going to have these points. And so basically what it is, if you think of the clock again, at the outer rim of 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock, those are two places where gravitationally, if something goes into that area, it locks into a stable orbit. And so therefore at 10 and 2, the solar observatory telescopes that we use to look at the sun constantly are placed in those areas because they literally don't need fuel to run. Basically, they just hit a synchronized orbit with the Earth and they're locked. They're not going to be going anywhere. There's 3 other points so those are what are called stable Lagrange points. There's 3 other points that are semi-stable Lagrange points at the rim of 6 o'clock, so basically the opposite side of where the Earth is. And then there's a point just in front of the moon, between the Earth and moon, and also a point beyond the moon, about 5 times the distance from the Earth to the moon, which is another Lagrange point. And that's where the James Webb telescope is being sent. And there's also some other probes out there, too. Now, so therefore, we can talk about 2 orbits of the James Webb telescope. So now that it's out to its Lagrange point, that it will now orbit the sun along with the Earth. But it also has a secondary orbit, similar to how, you know, the moon has two orbits. The moon orbits the Earth, but also orbits the sun, when you think about it. That the telescope, the James Webb telescope, will orbit this Lagrange point, because the Lagrange point there, if the telescope were to go right to the exact Lagrange point, it would be stuck, and they couldn't do anything with it. And actually, that's not where you want it to be, because one of the things, in order for James Webb to work, the solar panels have to constantly be in the sun. So what they do is, because there's this gravitational anomaly, even though there's nothing there, you can still orbit around that point. And so what they're going to do is have it perpendicular to the orbit of, you know, the Earth and sun. So if you think of it, like if you put a flat disk or a plate on your table, it would be like taking like a model wheel or something and fixing it on the side of your plate so you can kind of roll the plate around on your table on a wheel. It's going to be perpendicular sideways orbit. So then that way, it'll never be in the Earth or Moon shadow. The back end of it, the solar panels, will always be facing the sun. The telescope will never get hit by the sun and experience the most, the darkest nights you can imagine, and will be in this bizarre orbit around nothing but this gravitational Lagrange point as it's traveling around the sun. It's wild when you really get into this. You know, like, for example, with Lagrange points, there's a probe that's going out to Jupiter, because at their 10 and 2 Lagrange points are what are called Trojan asteroids. Basically, space junk from when the planets formed, but because of they got tidally locked in these Lagrange points, never were able to form into a planet. And some of the most ancient raw material in the universe. And that's when, you know, we talk about awe and wonder. You know, when you really get into this stuff, the universe is just spectacular.
Oh, yeah, it's good. And I actually kind of really understand what you're talking about these points, because, you know, each planet has a gravitational field. The analogy I was thinking of when you were saying it would be like, let's say you work in an office and you're really trying to get something done, but there's a person over here and a person over there and another one over there who each will try to grab your time to work on some project they're working on. You want to find the one spot where nobody can get to you. And so you go in the broom closet. But that's basically what it's doing. It's you're finding the spot out there in space where nothing is pulling it in any particular direction, so it can do what it wants to do. That's fascinating stuff. And also the fact that you have to wrap your head around the fact that the moon and Earth are orbiting in two directions at the same time. It's very interesting stuff. But we're going to take.
Actually, you can think about it in another direction too, because you also have to remember that the sun is orbiting around our galactic core. So therefore, there's even, and that's where, and sometimes it gets a little mind-numbing for people. When you get into space, up and down lose all sense of purpose and meaning. Because mm-hmm. the way that we understand up and down is just based on our experience of Earth. But in space, there really is no up and down. And I know that sometimes it's a hard concept for people to wrap their brain around, but it's like this little example of trying to figure out how they're going to get James Webb to orbit around a point of space with nothing in it begins to give that idea of that space is a lot more strange and beautiful than we realize it is.
Yeah, it really is. We're talking with Father James Krasinski. We're going to take a quick break. I got an interesting question to see that maybe we can also think about the scientific method and how that applies to stuff going on right here on Earth. We'll be right back after this here on Connecting the Diocese. Time now for a short news report from the Vatican Newsroom in Rome.
The Pope has joined his voice to those of bishops across North and South America to urge people to get jabbed against COVID-19. In a video message produced in conjunction with the Ad Council, Pope Francis praised the work of researchers and scientists in producing safe and effective COVID-19 vaccines.
Gracias a Dios y el trabajo de muchos. Hoy tenemos vacunas para protegernos.
He added that vaccines bring hope to end the pandemic, but only if they're available to all and if we collaborate with one another. Pope Francis went on to say that getting a COVID jab that is authorized by the respective authorities is an act of love. Helping others do the same, he said, is also an act of love.
Amor a uno mismo, amor a los familiares.
Love for oneself, love for our families and friends, and love for all peoples, he said. Love, he added, is also social and political. The Pope noted that social and political love is built up through small individual gestures capable of transforming and improving societies. Getting vaccinated is a simple yet profound way to care for one another, especially the most vulnerable, he said. Pope Francis then prayed to God that each one of us can make his or her own small gesture of love.
Por más pequeño que sea, el amor siempre es grande.
No matter how small, love is always grand, he said. Small gestures for a better future. The Pope was joined in the video by several church leaders from across the Americas. Archbishop Jose Gomez of Los Angeles lamented the suffering and death the pandemic has wrought across the globe. He prayed that God might grant us the grace to face it with the strength of faith, ensuring that vaccines are available for all so that we can all get immunized. Mexican Cardinal Carlos Aguirretes linked COVID-19 jabs to a better future for all, while Honduran Cardinal Rodriguez Maradiaga said the world has much to learn from the coronavirus. But one thing is certain, he added, the authorized vaccines are effective and are here to save lives, calling them the key to a path of personal and universal healing. I'm Devin Watkins.
Father James Krasinski, thank you so much for being with us. This is stuff, again, that even learning about those points in space, it just struck me with a little bit of awe. Like, you know, I learned something today, interesting. It may not particularly affect where my car keys are, but it's interesting that just to know about it, that I now know something that I had no idea about until you told me about it. One thing that is important, and you were talking about the stress of COVID going on 2 years of this craziness, is that I believe some people haven't stopped to fully understand the so-called scientific method. Science, well, I'll let you describe it, but basically they're saying, how come last year they said we should do this, and then 6 months later they said we should do this, and then they changed their mind and went back to this over here, or combined it with that? You know, why can't they figure it out and give us one answer that we can follow?
Yeah.
The reason is the scientific method, right?
Correct. You know, and that's a great analogy of how one of the things, and I kind of was afraid this was going to happen when COVID hit, that before COVID happened, and a good analogy for it is oftentimes the faith and science wars that we sometimes would see with new atheism, that type of stuff. What that created was an obsession with certitude. We have to be completely 100% right or completely 100% wrong in everything. And that's something that our culture was, you know, really falling into. We even see it within our political sphere. Regardless of what political party you're a part of, what's the biggest mistake that any president, Republican or Democrat or Independent, can make to admit you're wrong? And so therefore there was this cultural baggage of an obsession with certitude that, to be quite frank, when you think about it, is just wrong to begin with. Sure, I can sit down with a married couple who have been married for 50 years. When did you know you were going to get married? And their love is certain now, but most of the time the couples don't give me a specific point of, oh, this is when I absolutely knew. But usually it's a series of events that led them to make a leap of faith. Not a blind leap of faith, but with the experience they had together, and the journey that they decided to take each other's hands to step into the sacred tomorrow of the unknown to receive the sacrament of marriage, and away they went. And I think that that's a good starting point, because when COVID hit, when you have something new, like a new virus or a new disease, there's things that initially were known. This is a disease of the SARS family. COVID-19 implies that there are 18 previous, you know, iterations before this specific one hit. There was, and this is where you got to be careful with the politics of it, this originated in Wuhan. Who knew what, and what did they know, and who shared, and that kind of stuff. But the hard part with that is that science never in any field promises doctrine. Meaning, you know, we as a people of faith, we speak of the doctrine of the Eucharist or the doctrine of unchanging truth that govern our lives. The highest level of truth that science comes to is theory. Now, theory is a lot stronger in science than, you know, like a theory in philosophy or a theory in theology. But it always leaves room for mistakes. It always leaves room to be able to know better with new data and more data. And then on top of that, when you deal with viruses, they mutate. And there's a certain you're not really going to know much about it until there's no way to definitively predict mutation. So at the beginning, you know, we had our, you know, first form of COVID that led to the nation's shutdown and a lot of fear. We don't have vaccines for it. We don't have treatments for it. It seems to be deadly. What can we do? Then after a while, we got the vaccines, and predictably, the vaccination level, it's getting better now, but it reflected political ideology at first. It had certain political ideas about vaccination, got vaccinated or not vaccinated based on those politics, or because of legitimate health reason. You know, I have some parishioners, for example, who want to get vaccinated but can't because they have medical conditions that could become life-threatening if they get vaccinated. And so, therefore, science continues to study the disease, asking the questions of how do we get this under control, comes up with solutions. The virus is going to mutate and do what it does. And it kind of becomes a trying to stay ahead of something that is at a distinct advantage.
It's interesting that people will say, you know, well, I'm not going to worry about the vaccine because it doesn't work. Well, no, it does work, and it did work. The virus has mutated to a new challenge. It's kind of like when I got a new, what do they call it, HE, high efficiency clothes washer. Detergent that I used to use on the old washer that was on a Maytag that was 30 years old, you know, brute force cleaning, it no longer worked as well.
Yeah.
And I had to get a special new liquid that was designed for HE washers. It's the same thing. The virus is changing its attributes from one thing to another, and so you've got to adjust, and it that is the scientific method, basically. You see what's changed, and you respond to it, and then someone else finds another piece of the puzzle, and things move along. Now, that's the scientific method.
And that's why, for me, it can be hard sometimes as a priest to wade through all the stuff with COVID, because, for example, on one side of the spectrum, Father, the vaccines failed. Look at what's happening. Well, no, the vaccines didn't fail. The vaccines performed the way that they should. Now, in order for us to get a sense of herd immunity, we needed to reach a certain percentage of population vaccinated. We didn't reach that, so more people could get infected, and then you have the mutation. As is often the case, mutations sometimes mutate in a way where it becomes more difficult for the vaccines to do their job. So, and then, well, then the other end of the spectrum, well, see, Father, then you're saying that it's everybody's fault who didn't get vaccinated. No, I'm not saying that either, because there's a lot of different reasons why people didn't get vaccinated, and there still would be mutations. And granted, might we be in a better position if we would have hit those benchmarks? Probably. We'll never know. But I think that that's the thing that worries me moving out of COVID, is that both faith and science have taken serious hits in terms of trust with the general public. Before COVID hit, trust was really shaken in the people of God with the clergy sex abuse scandal. And now COVID-19, out of fairness to those who may be listening who are victims of clergy sex abuse, I'm not going to make a direct equation of both, but COVID-19 has definitely shaken trust in people in terms of science. And I think that there's a part of it on both ends that we have to acknowledge is legitimate, that, as you were saying, has there been a lot of speculation by scientists and non-scientists about what the silver bullet is for all this? Yes. But I think if you listen to honest science and honest faith, both ends of the spectrum were very sober about what could be expected, and nobody that's legitimate in the scientific community promised that nobody would get sick once vaccines were out. There were going to be breakthroughs, and they knew that. But it's, again, what can we do to promote human dignity at every stage of life, and what role can vaccines do to minimize the, we're approaching 1 million deaths in the United States from COVID after over these last 2 years. You know, what can we do to reduce that and allow people to have their dignity?
Well, also, a big question, and I don't have the answer to this, but as a priest, you see this pretty often, I suspect. If people suddenly decide that, A, they don't trust science, you know, facts, they don't trust what the government is saying for a variety of reasons, they don't trust what religion is telling them, something fills those voids.
Yep.
And I can't speak to the political side, and I can't speak to the science. Well, for the science side, I mean, there's all kinds of weirdness out there. But what bothers me the most is from the religious side, that if you throw out everything, you've got this huge void in your life where you don't trust anything.
Yep.
And you don't believe anything. There is, I was going to say the truth is out there, but that sounds too X-Files. But there is a gigantic wealth of true faith out there. There is a Holy Spirit. There are all kinds of things. If you shut it out, it won't exist for you as far as you're concerned, but it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And I would urge you to spend some time with your local parish and explore. Suddenly, you know, the light bulb may turn on and you go, wait a minute, I've been throwing out the baby with the bathwater here. I automatically, on the very few online comments that I still see anymore on national newspapers, the minute I hit the ignore button, people I don't even want to hear, whenever they make a gross, all religion is rotten, you're not going to talk to them. But it doesn't mean that I hope someday that they suddenly realize that that's not really what goes on.
I just wrote a piece on this for the Sacred Space Astronomy blog, precisely to this point, that on how, you know, when you really look at the tension between faith and science, when you really dig into it, 9 times out of 10, the tension isn't between faith and science. The tension is that there's mistrust and very different worldviews. And how can we, one, not forsake who we are in terms of our understanding of children of God, and two, how can we enter into dialogue with people that have different worldviews with us, not in a combative sense, but to realize a scientist who happens to be atheist, because there are very devout Christian scientists as well, they are very sincere in what they do. They don't try to fake their data. They're not out to, this is the worldview they come from. And how can we enter in a spirit of growth with them to try to share our truth, invite them to understand the truth in terms of how we understand faith, try to understand where they're coming from so that we can move together and not just be a part of these continual cultural spitting matches that really accomplish nothing.
Yeah, accomplish nothing is it. I think that, again, if people can take time to listen to the ideas of others and not just throw them out immediately, we'll get better on that. We'll get better on that. Again, I spend my time sitting here for 2 years now, essentially isolated. I mean, we don't go out much because we're old enough that we're a little bit concerned about getting COVID-19. But in terms of faith, the good part of it for me is that every week I get to talk to people like you, people doing good works, people helping adopt children, people doing all these things that are direct outgrowths of gospel faith, of they're what they believe. And I'm sure if we were in a country that was primarily Buddhist and I was running a Buddhist radio show, same thing would happen. There's so much good being done that comes out of trying to understand your place in God's world and how that affects the rest of the world, that it's good. And people who are missing out on that, who are just ignoring it completely and totally and will have nothing to do with any religion whatsoever. Boy, I hope you just take a little bit of time to think about it.
The hardest thing for me, and thank you so much for that compliment, by the way, I deeply appreciate it. The hardest thing for me as a priest through COVID is that on both ends of the spectrum, I deal a lot with people who think that they have the definitive answer, and to the point of, to put it mildly, you know, uncharitable sentiments about me and about the church and about, and that just, that's not the starting point. I mean, the honest answer is none of us have the ultimate key on how do we get through COVID except for the Lord. And so that's why we have to stay close to God, realizing we don't have the answers to how to get through, but the Lord does. And if we stay close to the Lord and one another, and, you know, I have yet to find in this whole pandemic anybody who revels in the idea of wanting to make choices that'll kill people. And I haven't met anybody who's trying to spark a socialist overthrow of the country through mask wearing. I have found people who have very different approaches and understandings to the how do we live with COVID. A lot of emotional responses that are different about the fear of what COVID is and what it is. And people who are very sincere. So let's capitalize on the sincerity. Let's just drop, you know, let the pressure, let the temperature chill on a lot of the arguments we get into and realize we're trying to figure out how to love each other. And we have very different views on how that is, but let's not let those views become what divide us, but let the Lord unite us and invite the sciences in to inform us on what are good ways to move forward on that.
Good words, Father. We have to kind of end the show on that good note. We've had a little bit of fun trying to understand the awe and mystery of what's out there in the physical world. And there's a lot of awe and mystery in the world of God that we haven't. We need some kind of huge telescope to aim.
There you go. I was joking because when James Webb gets going, Hubble is up for a decommission pretty soon.
Yeah.
And I as a joke, I floated to, because part of our conference was to visit different observatories in Arizona, and I float, what do I have to do to get my name on the Hubble list once it gets decommissioned? And they just laugh. I'm like, sorry, Father, but we're pretty sure a pretty impressive line of professional scientists will be ahead of you on the list to claim the Hubble.
To use it themselves, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
You might have to get into one of Jeff Bezos's spacecraft and fly out to it with a Sanford Sharpie and write your name on it and say, this belongs to me.
Water rights.
But that thing will still keep working, and people will be using it for other things as well. But there's a lot of, it's just, we're living in an amazing time, and every once in a while, there's a series of space, outer space, I will call it, stuff that happens in pretty close succession. These craft going up, this going up, the rover going up, that makes you sit there and go, this is kind of the future that the science fiction writers were talking about years ago. We were actually living in the middle of it, so it's kind of fun just to take a look at it once in a while.
Sure is.
Father James Krasinski, the pastor of St. Olaf Parish in Eau Claire, thank you so much for being here and just opening up the doors. And now I have learned something about how you stay in one place in space.
There you go. Look up your Lagrange points.
There you go. Thank you so much for being here.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jack.
That was Father James Krasinski from St. Olaf Parish in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, talking about all kinds of things in space and elsewhere. My name is Jack Socia. This is the Connecting the Diocese radio show from the Diocese of La Crosse, Wisconsin. At the beginning of this show, I was giving you a little bit of space history, talking about the Telstar communication satellite put up around 1962. It had a lot of bling. I mean, it looked really cool. It got its own song. What more can you say? Everybody was really proud of this thing going up. But the funny thing was, around the same time, actually a year before and a little bit after, another satellite was put up. This other satellite was called the Echo 1. It simply did not have the pizzazz. It did not have the flash of Telstar. It didn't even have as cool a name. And so, among other things, it didn't get much notice, and it didn't get its own song. What was it? Why didn't it get all the attention? Basically, all it was a hollow silver ball. That's right, a hollow silver ball. It was actually manufactured, of all places, in Northfield, Minnesota. So we're not talking about the center of the universe here. And what it was designed for was they'd shoot this thing up, uninflated, and then it would inflate. And it was big. I mean, it was two stories high. Big silver plastic ball. And then they bounced microwaves off it. In one test, they actually shot some microwaves up at the thing, and then it bounced them over to the East Coast, where they were received in New Jersey. But now here is, as they say, the beauty part. The Echo 1 was completely manufactured of something brand new, a new kind of flexible, stretchable plastic that was called Mylar. And it was coated with a silver coating. Does this sound familiar to you? Coming up in February, we have Valentine's Day. How many of you are going to go over and buy this shiny inflatable balloon thing on a stick, right? Shaped like a heart or whatever? Guess what that's made of? Mylar. And if you ever go camping or have an emergency blanket, those kind of things in your car, guess what those are made of? Mylar. So that's your little trickle down from the space program back in 1961. But I still think that it should have its own song. So I'm going to leave you with what I consider the unofficial theme song for the Echo 1 hollow balloon satellite. We'll see you next week right here on Connecting the Diocese.
Would you like to ride? Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? We could float among the stars together, you and I.
For we can fly, up and away, my beautiful balloon.
The world's a nicer place.
some change, you find yourself loving me.
The moon beside us,
your love is waiting there.